curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is News for the Rest of Us. Thanks for tuning in. This week, we share a clip from the first episode of the latest season of the Courage My Friends podcast series. In this episode, independent journalist and public historian Taylor C. Noakes, author, political economist, and senior researcher with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, Ricardo Tranjan, and social justice activist and former organizer for the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, John Clark, reflect on the current state of progressive politics in Canada. Here is a small clip of that conversation. Take a listen.
John, Ricardo, and Taylor, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us. Taylor, this episode is largely inspired by an opinion piece you wrote for the Toronto Star last year entitled, "We Need a New Progressive Political Party in Canada." So to get us started, and in a nutshell, because we will be parsing this out, why do we need a new progressive party?
So I think the established political parties in Canada are just that. They are far too established. They have become organizations unto themselves that seek self-preservation above all else. And I think that it has essentially prevented them, by and large, from experiencing the kind of renewal that's necessary to keep political parties vibrant and connected to people and their day-to-day concerns. I would also suggest that the creation of a new political party is an opportunity not just for renewal, but also a reassertion of values and objectives. And I think that hasn't been done in Canada in quite some time. I think that in order to keep progressive politics fresh, they need to be renewed. And the creation of a political party is one potential avenue to do that.
Thank you. John, what is your take on the current state of progressive political representation at the federal level in Canada?
Well, I think the level is very low. I mean, we have two political parties, the Conservatives and the Liberals, who clearly represent the other side. And we have a third formation, the NDP, that seems to have great difficulty putting very much daylight between itself and the Liberal Party. So there is really an acute need for an electoral initiative and a political formation that actually can address that by advancing, I would say, broadly progressive perspectives. I mean, I'm not asking for or expecting a fully perfect left program, but what I think is really needed is electoral initiative that actually distances itself from the prevailing regressive agenda that is just being sworn in the White House. We need something that runs contrary to austerity. We need organizations that are prepared to stand up in solidarity with Palestine, that kind of basic formation. I think as well that probably it's not going to emerge by a series of backroom negotiations. It's much more likely to emerge out of the actual practical struggles, workplace and community-based, that are unfolding across this country.
Now, just to clarify some of the terms, is there a difference between progressive and left?
Well, I think that's somewhat debatable. I mean, perhaps progressive has a somewhat broader connotation than a specific notion of left politics that clearly stands for socialist ideas and such like. I certainly think that's the case, but I think the line has to be drawn when it comes to defining a meaningful positive initiative as one that actually is prepared to distance itself from and actively challenge the prevailing agenda rather than just simply prop it up in the House of Commons.
Who are actually the progressive and or left parties in Canada right now at the federal level? Because we have more than the big five. We actually have quite a few federally registered parties. So we have the NDP, the Green. Who else? Anybody can jump in.
I mean, I don't see myself as any political formation that is currently contesting elections with any reasonable possibility of getting someone elected that would fit that bill. There are certainly tendencies and individuals within those organizations, left NDP people, for example, who have that perspective. But I don't think that there's anywhere you could say this political party, this political formation represents a progressive alternative at this point in time.
Not at this point in time, right? But we do have in the running among the small parties as well. We've long had the Socialist Party of Canada. We've had the Communist Party of Canada. The Liberals define themselves as central left. I think the Bloc, same thing. But again, this needs to be questioned. So in 2015, the Trudeau Liberals came in on a fairly progressive platform. I'm going to be using that word a lot, but a fairly progressive platform with strong commitments on issues like climate, reconciliation, housing, etc. However, Ricardo, you've described this as not so much progressive, but rather progressive neoliberalism. What is progressive neoliberalism and how did this play out under the Liberals?
I want to first take a step back mm-hmm. and respond to some of the comments that others just made. Mm-hmm. I think the Canadian left needs a smaller tent. This notion of progressive politics is too broad. It includes too many people. It includes groups who are forever committed to reconciling the capitalist logic of accumulation with some mild form of social equality, and that prevents a smaller and stronger group of individuals and groups to spend time formulating and developing strategies to defend a truly leftist agenda for this country. And I find that it is very unlikely for a political party to lead this process unless it's a political party that is not focused on winning elections, which does exist and is quite common in other political systems, but it is not very common in our political system because there's so few major parties and because of the first past the post system. So I think it's really important to differentiate a left that is committed to start with social democratic reforms and take it from there to a much more radical project, and progressive politics that anyone in any times can claim themselves to be, as long as there is slightly to the left or whatever right-wing politician we have in government right now, right? Mm-hmm. To address your question more directly, this notion of progressive neoliberalism is Nancy Fraser's concept, a political philosopher in the U.S., who used that term to refer to, originally to Bill Clinton, but then also applied to Barack Obama and to Clinton and the UK. It is politicians and political formations that adopted or co-opted some of the language of social movements, especially language related to demands for inclusion from movements more based on identity politics. And then they managed to adopt and co-opt that language and then to some extent incorporate some of those demands in their platforms, while on the economic, both fiscal and monetary policies, preserving the status quo and continuing to be aligned with big financial centers and the most kind of traditional capitalist groups. Nancy Fraser was writing that before Justin Trudeau, but I think Justin Trudeau kind of took that to a new level. And then for me, if there was ever a picture of progressive neoliberalism, would be Justin Trudeau's original cabinet of ministers, which was gender balanced and yet had Bill Morneau as the Minister of Finance.
And just to go into some examples, because I know you've talked about how we saw that playing out through climate policy or through housing.
Yes, one quick and concrete example on housing. The federal government had not been actively involved in housing since the mid-1990s. So Justin Trudeau government comes and says, we're going to have a national housing strategy. There's going to involve a lot of consultations. We're going to bring a lot of groups to the table. And the entire professional civil society gets all excited. And everyone is participating in these consultations. And there's progressive terms thrown left and right, including the right to housing and other such language. And then when you look at the strategy year in, year out, the bulk of the strategy is providing more subsidies and different tax breaks and different forms of incentives to private developers. that is the core of the national housing strategy. That's where most of the money was spent on. That's where the most number of measures have focused on. And then a very small amount of money sent directly to non-market housing, very much within the sort of minimalist welfare state mindset where the very poor won't be served by the rental market. So we need to provide them provision, but, you know, keeping that very minimal. But everything else has to be the market, the market, the market, the market. And also the third and final piece of that, no regulation, no willingness to impose rent controls, no willingness to review the preferential tax treatment of real estate investment trusts, all that, that regulatory front where there's so much that can be done in-house that would have an immediate impact on folks, but that would require the Liberal Party to essentially antagonize the real estate industry. We went nowhere near that. So I think that's where we see a lot of language, a lot of cool terms, and the cooptation of endless numbers of meetings and civil society groups involved with this government and in the various housing initiatives. And yet, all we're doing is really providing more financial incentives for private developers so they continue to profit immensely from housing.
And the housing crisis continues and actually continues to worsen as well. It's interesting, this terminology, progressive neoliberalism, when you take it beyond borders. In terms of global politics, I think another term gaining traction is woke imperialism, where, again, it's the great ideas that are the camouflage, but not necessarily the cause being distinctly different and opposite to that. Now, on January 6th, just to bring in some more immediate context of this year, Prime Minister Trudeau resigned as Liberal Party leader, prorogued Parliament, and launched a Liberal leadership contest, the result of which is expected on March 9th, shortly before Parliament resumes on March 24th. The Conservative and NDP promise to bring down government could trigger an early election, and we may see the end of nearly 10 years of Liberal government. So a question for all of you, starting with you, John, and you actually started to talk about this. What should a progressive, I keep using this term, but if you can give me another word, that'd be good. But what should a more progressive governing platform or agenda look like?
That's a very difficult thing to assess in the sense that it doesn't look good at the moment. Clearly, the Conservatives have a great deal of traction. We're dealing with a situation where the Liberal Party has exhausted its shelf life, and it's part of a broader crisis of the political centre, which is not proving itself capable of withstanding the rise of the right. There should be a party that is advancing clear alternatives, precisely along the kind of dividing line that was just put forward. There should be clear platform positions that call for effective action to deal with the housing crisis, which means addressing the commodification of housing that is at the root of the thing, that talks about strengthening vital public services, that talks about all the things that are needed, that on foreign policy issues advances very, very clear positions that challenge the dominant status quo, that challenge imperialism, whether it's woke or not. Those kinds of things are needed. The simple reality is that they don't exist. And they're unlikely to exist in the next election. But that's exactly the perspective that has to be put forward, I think.
Right. And it is a very changing global context as well. Canada doesn't exist in a vacuum. You also have multipolarity that is very quickly rising around the world as well. John, when was the last time that we had a good progressive governing agenda or something that really could appeal to the needs of the vast majority? Have we ever in Canada?
Well, I mean, we've certainly at an earlier period before my time, because I came here from abroad, but we did have in various countries during the post-war years, you have governments or parties that were running for government that advanced perspectives with regards to strengthening the social infrastructure and certainly not making fundamental or radical changes in society, but advancing positions that would actually make a difference in people's lives. In the country I grew up, the great example was the Attlee government of 1945 that brought in the National Health Service and a whole series of very, very, very major measures. Those things happened. But the reality is that those platforms were tailored to the possibilities that existed at that time. The advent of the neoliberal agenda, I think, created an effective austerity consensus. And really and truly, at this point, the main parties that have any pretensions of being progressive, whether they're liberal or social democratic, have essentially bought into that austerity consensus. And that's the great problem. And there is a need for a political alternative to be advanced that actually breaks with that agenda.
Sort of the shift to the right that we've seen with all of the political parties, certainly. Taylor, basically the same question to you. What are progressive voters looking for?
I wanted to touch on a couple of points that were just made, but number one being that I agree with a lot of what John just said. And I think that a true progressive alternative right now could distinguish itself from the mainstream establishment parties, but would have to do so in more of just saying that, well, you know, we oppose what they believe in. I think one of the problems with progressive parties is they don't often clearly articulate what their objectives and values are. It can't just simply be an opposition to whatever the other guy is saying. But that being said, I think to John's point, if a progressive party were to simply articulate, not simply returning to an anti-austerity agenda, but to actually articulate what kinds of programs it would want to institute, if that is a return to the social welfare state of, let's say, the post-depression, post-war years, to actually spell out what that means. They have to be cognizant of the fact that there's several generations of voters who would have little to no concept of what that actually means in real-world terms. So I think articulating those goals would be crucial. In terms of, you know, what is progressivism versus leftism, et cetera, whether it's the creation of a new political movement or a new political party, that's an opportunity to redefine those terms. And to a degree, I think it boils down to a matter of branding and marketing. And I'm not saying that as someone who's particularly interested in either of those things. But as an example, contemporary conservative politics really aren't often that conservative. There's elements of traditionalism. There's elements of populism. But in terms of a lot of economic issues, conservative politics nowadays tend to be quite interventionist. I had the misfortune of watching Poiliev's interview with Jordan Peterson, where Poiliev, the apparent conservative, was strongly advocating for additional federal government intervention at the behest of the oil and gas industry to expand it. And these are not traditional conservative values, intervention in the market. But, you know, nonetheless, that's where they're at. Whether it's the creation of a new political party or the establishment of a new movement, an association, what have you, that's an opportunity to redefine those terms and to make them quite clear what that means, but for the specific purposes of achieving political goals later on, right? I think that might be worthwhile, is to establish, okay, one group through a convention or what have you is essentially deciding what progress means in contemporary Canadian political terms. I think that could be a very useful exercise and would potentially avoid some of the pitfalls that we just experienced in this conversation we just had, right? Earlier, Resh, you had asked to identify what are the sort of the left progressive political parties in Canada, and we all kind of had a hard time figuring that out. Because it's not clear. So as far as I'm concerned, the first group of people that goes out and says, this is what it is, and we have consensus because we had a convention, we did polling, we talked to these experts, et cetera, here's our receipts, this is why we're saying X is progressive. The first group that does that, I think, is going to benefit immensely, because a bunch of people in Canada will say, oh yeah, that's what I believe. I'm going to vote for those guys or do whatever they tell me to do. And I don't think that's fundamentally a bad thing at all. Someone needs to come out and say, you know, in Canada, we used to have a social welfare state. It was created because of the consequences of the Depression and the war. It led to the following benefits. If you like this stuff, vote for these guys, or, you know, you're part of this political movement. But no one's actually connecting those dots. And I think in Canadian politics, there's a lot of assumption that this knowledge is ingrained in the populace. It is not. There's several generations of Canadians that have little to no experience with that social welfare state. And the group of people that do, the baby boomers, they are in their senior years and are falling off. And that transfer of knowledge, I don't think, has been done. It's a golden opportunity for whoever picks up the mantle.
Right. Now, I mean, and there has been a bit of a crisis, particularly with younger generations, and that perhaps they have not had in their lifetimes an example of good, responsive leadership. But going to that point that you just brought up, that, you know, that there are no groups or that we're not able to clearly identify progressive leadership. We do have many unions and activist groups who are calling for new progressive leadership, and they see this hope. within the NDP. What would be your response to that?
There is nothing I would like more right now than for the NDP to, be firing with both barrels and go on the complete offensive. They've had many opportunities. There's a golden opportunity right now, particularly as it relates to organized labor, to tackle this issue of proposed annexation and tariff wars. There's a golden opportunity for the NDP to remind everyone that they are the Labor Party of Canada, the Working People's Party, et cetera, et cetera. Golden opportunity that I feel they're simply not picking up. Maybe there's some backroom stuff that's happening that I don't know about, but I have not seen the aggressive messaging that I think needs to happen. To me, Jagmeet does not come across as a labor leader per se, nor an individual who has close or common cause with working people. I hope that's just an image problem that could be potentially corrected. But I'm not overly optimistic that they can correct that image problem in the near term. That being said, there is an absolute crisis going on right now in terms of the terrible lot that the Canadian worker has to deal with. But because of those reasons, there's renewed interest in organized labor and in addressing a wide variety of common problems that are the result of neoliberal economic policies. So again, golden opportunity, and there'd be nothing better than for a party or a movement to come out and say, this is the new organized labor party slash movement in Canada. And this kind of goes back to the whole reason why I wrote this article in the first place, even though it was a year ago. Organized labor, just as much as established political parties, I believe, suffer from the same problem. They are institutions unto themselves that have demonstrated a poor track record in terms of adapting to changing circumstances and engaging with younger demographics.
Okay, thank you for that. Ricardo, I want to bring you in on this as well. And, given that this is also the first election that's coming since the end, I put that in question marks, the end of the pandemic. Again, what should a progressive platform include that would appeal to people who want real change? And are you seeing this on offer from any of the federal parties?
No, I'm not seeing it on offer.
That was Taylor C. Noakes, Ricardo Tranjan, and John Clark in conversation with Courage My Friends host Resh Bedu. To listen to the full episode, tune in to Needs No Introduction, home of the Courage My Friends podcast series. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. Here to bring us up to date is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, Justice Mary Jose Hogue issued her report on foreign interference in Canada's last two federal elections on Monday, January 28th. Her report assured Canadians that while foreign actors like China and Russia did take an interest in Canadian elections, their actions had no bearing on the outcome of those votes. Hogue's report did outline ongoing existential threats to Canadian democracy, however, including misinformation spread through social media platforms. The largest social media platforms in the world are owned by American tech billionaires. Hogue warned that rather than China and Russia, it was the U.S. that was having the most influence on Canadian politics and elections. Since the election of Donald Trump, social media platforms have scaled back on their commitments to fact-checking and fighting misinformation. Hogue said that misinformation on social media platforms can be used to undermine the integrity and confidence in Canadian elections. In Ontario news, Premier Doug Ford has called an early election. The announcement was made on Monday, January 28th. This election is being held 15 months earlier than the scheduled date of the spring of 2026. Ford said that he needs a new mandate from the people in order to respond to the threat of U.S. President Donald Trump to impose a 25% tariff on Canadian goods. The election will be held on February 27th. But the tariffs are scheduled to go into effect this Saturday. On Monday, a coalition of different unions from a range of industries held a press conference denouncing Ford's early election call. Laura Walton, president of the Ontario Federation of Labour, pointed out that Ford was the only premier calling for an early election in response to the tariffs, and that he had a history of acting without the consent of voters. So, why go to them now? Instead, Walton and her labor allies called on the premier to form a task force made up of representatives from their movement, community leaders, and members of opposition parties. In labor news, workers are calling on the Canadian government to cut ties with Amazon. Last week, Amazon announced that it was closing all of its warehouses in Quebec, cutting 1,900 jobs and closing the only unionized Amazon warehouse in Canada. On Sunday night, Amazon warehouse workers and their allies held an emergency assembly at the Immigrant Workers Center in Montreal. At that meeting, the assembly passed a resolution calling on the federal government to cut all ties and cancel all contracts with Amazon in response to the closures. Federal Minister of Public Services and Procurement Jean-Yves Duclos is already pushing back on Amazon's decision to close the warehouses. In a statement released to the media, Duclos says, quote, "It's not acceptable to punish workers because they became unionized. In Canada, the right to become unionized is a right that is fundamental," end quote. And finally, last year, McGill University in Montreal became the first post-secondary institution to eliminate residence assistance from university dorms. Termed floor fellows at McGill, these residence assistants were often the first point of contact for young students living on campus and away from home for the first time. They often were a source of support for students experiencing difficulties and could connect them with mental health and other support services. In a statement to Rabble.ca, McGill said that the decision to cut floor fellows was not financially motivated, but the university is saving $165,000 on the move. The story was covered by Rabble's 2024 to 2025 Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow, Eleanor Wand. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
connection to our community matters. Local radio is the link. When you tune in wherever you are, you're part of a conversation that makes us all stronger. But local stations aren't getting the support they deserve from the government. Your support is vital. We're asking you to support the Community Radio Initiative. Write the government. Tell them how important this station is. MyCRI.ca is the place to get all the information so we can work together to make a difference. MyCRI.ca.